You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis.
I just got a lot on the line here. I mean, I screwed up my whole life. That's why I need to get to the moon. I go up to the moon, I'm a hero.
Well, I'm with you, Cap.
Let's show NASA that we know what we're doing. Our water tank is empty. I've started up the urine recycling machine.
That is very salty.
Welcome to Moonbase 8. This is a very valuable NASA research project.
Launch sequence beginning in 9, 8, 9, 7, 8, 6, 5.
Stand by, let's sync up.
4, 3.
Abort.
Stand by, Cap.
Launching.
No. Yeah!
That was John C. Reilly, Tim Heidecker, and Fred Armisen in Showtime's new comedy series, Moonbase 8. Set in the isolated desert of Winslow, Arizona, at NASA's Moonbase Simulator, Moonbase 8 follows three eager astronauts, Skip, Rook, and their leader, Cap, as they attempt to qualify for their first lunar mission. While working vigorously to complete their training, a series of unexpected circumstances forces the astronauts to question their own mental sanity, trust in each other, and whether or not they're cut out for space travel. And today, I'm happy to be joined by the co-star, co-creator, and co-writer, Tim Heidecker, who talks about his character's very different sort of mission to the moon, how the four comedy geniuses, including director Jonathan Kreisel, collaborated on every aspect of the series, and what it was like to visit NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab and SpaceX headquarters as part of their research for the show. Tim also discusses how Bob Odenkirk gave him his first break, the borderline obsessive cult following for his Adult Swim series Tim and Eric Awesome Show, and how one Tim and Eric sketch got the attention of QAnon conspiracists. He also gets into how his other series, On Cinema, plays on everything from social media influencer culture to the rise of the alt-right. Plus, Tim weighs in on the Moon versus Mars debate, his tongue-in-cheek run for San Bernardino District Attorney, and more. Coming up with Tim Heidecker in just a moment. Tim Heidecker is best known as one half of the comedy duo Tim and Eric, having co-created and starred in the television shows Tom Goes to the Mayor, Tim and Eric Awesome Show, Great Job, and Tim and Eric's Bedtime Stories. He currently co-hosts the humorous film review web series On Cinema and stars in the comedy series Decker, both alongside Greg Turkington. Heidecker starred in last year's movie Mr. America, as well as other films like Bridesmaids, Tim and Eric's billion-dollar movie, Ant-Man and the Wasp, and Us. And now he stars with John C. Reilly and Fred Armisen in the new comedy series Moonbase 8, which debuts on Showtime November 8th. Tim Heidecker, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Tim, you hail from Allentown, Pennsylvania, as I recall. Is Allentown considered the Rust Belt? Is that Steel Town, or where do you come from? Tell us a little about that.
It sits right next to Bethlehem. So you had Bethlehem Steel and Allentown had Mack Trucks. It was very blue collar. I mean, when I was growing up in the 80s, it was starting to shrink and it was the steel mills were sort of phasing out. As far as I know, there's a lot of people commuting from Allentown to New York and to Philadelphia, bit of a bedroom community. But it's got a Germanic, Pennsylvania Dutch kind of conservative quality to it as well. I haven't been back in a while, to be honest.
Oh, really? Yeah, I confess that I know almost nothing about Allentown, almost nothing. I literally have one very obscure reference for Allentown, and it relates to an old movie, 42nd Street. Mm. It's one of those old backstage musicals where the star breaks her ankle and some ingenue has to step in and save the day the night before the opening or whatever. And in the movie, she doesn't think that she can cut it. And she gets, cold feet right before the curtain goes up and says something like, "I'm just going to quit the show and go back home to Allentown." And the director of the show grabs her by the shoulders and he says, "Allentown, I'm offering you the chance to star in the biggest Broadway show in 20 years. And you say Allentown?"
I'm going to grab that audio for my podcast. That sounds great.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's actually sort of derisive of your hometown. It makes it sound like it's synonymous with giving up now. Allentown, PA, a place for quitters.
Well, I got out, but yeah. I always thought, there's beautiful things about it. It's right butted up against lots of rural, farmland. And also there's some mountains, you're close to the Poconos, there's rivers, and there's great colleges there. So I feel like there's the potential for it to just be a great kind of Portland of the East, but
true.
I forgot about that.
I think I dated a girl who went to college. She was in college there. What is the college in Allentown? I don't remember.
It was Lehigh University. There's Muhlenberg. Okay. Those are the big two, I think.
And now, of course, we're recording this the day before the election. Who do you think is going to win Pennsylvania, Biden or Trump?
Oh, well, I hate to prognosticate. Is that the right word?
It is for our purposes. Prognosticate.
I have no idea. I feel so stupid for, I'm a fairly outspoken lefty. Mm-hmm. And I feel very embarrassed to have felt confident last time. Yeah. And so I just don't, I'm trying not to get invested in any of the narratives I'm being told about who's going to win.
Yeah, yeah.
That's very much like Joe Biden to win. He wasn't my first pick as a candidate for the Democrats, but I can't stand what Trump has done to us as a country, and I hope that we can send a message that he isn't wanted. His types aren't wanted around these parts.
Yeah. Now, I was a fan of your movie last year, Mr. America. And it seemed to me to very much be a commentary on Trump and Trumpism, talking about white supremacy and disenfranchisement of a minority voters. But I can't really recall if you actually mentioned Trump in the film, did you?
No, and that was pretty intentional. My character in On Cinema did sort of endorse him by name, but we felt that it was stronger to just kind of let the audience draw that conclusion, put that together all the signs were there. I think it just makes it for a more satisfying experience.
Yeah. And Mr. America is an extension of your show On Cinema, which also within that universe, there's your other show, Decker. They all sort of exist under that umbrella. And you and your co-creator and co-star, Greg, have built quite a cult following. Do you ever have any qualms about having to feed that beast now? Or, do you ever chafe at the constraints of creating within that universe?
No, I don't, the only frustrating thing is doing more with the way we've been doing it in the past. I think we're always trying to expand the universe and go bigger with it. There's just always been a conflict at Adult Swim where there's never the budgets to do that. And I think right now there's no real active plans to make more because, their idea of a web show is a green screen and a live stream of people talking. And we want to do more than that. And that requires, we've done 10 seasons or 12 seasons of that show where we shoot basically an entire season in one day. It's a little crazy, and we just are at a place where we're like, well, we want another day, we would like another day.
Yeah.
And that we're not, yeah. I don't know. But we just have a bucket of ideas that we want to do in that world that we're just dying to do. But you know, there's the fans are great and they play along. And of course, there's people that don't play along quite as well as others. And there's that. But it's been a great the fan base for that show is really some of the funniest.
And I love the conceit of On Cinema, that your character is someone who wants to build a following and create a brand for the financial gain and his own aggrandizement, but doesn't really have any passion for movies or what he's actually putting out there. It's a great comment on podcasts and TikTok celebrities, Instagram, these things that should be creative, but are often just these passionless pursuits of influence over others.
That's right. I'm glad you drilled in on that. That's one of the central premises of the show. You said it better than I could ever say it.
There are always these plugs for, you know, money and dollar signs and stuff like that. The id keeps poking through there. And
this
I can't
hear with all the Trump sort of literal snake oil salesmanship from Trump,
right.
You know, with the COVID stuff. You know, one of the previous seasons, we did a whole thing with this product I was selling called Riogenesis, which was guaranteed to kill all germs. And, you know, we do write this stuff. We just write it before that actually happens in real life.
So. Yeah, you kind of put something out into the air, I guess.
Yeah.
Someone picks up on it.
I hope we're not responsible for it. But just the other day, we did, you know, Kim Kardashian put that thing out with the hologram of her dad that everybody was passing around. And another thing where we had done a similar joke on Cinema a few years ago, where we had my character's dead son show up as a hologram as an adult. And it's just those things where we're like, I guess we just keep.
Yeah. Well, you know, but The Simpsons runs into the same problem. And I think South Park too, you know, The Simpsons predicted a Trump presidency years and years ago.
I guess it's true. Yeah. You write the absurd, stuff because it's absurd and funny, and that's entertaining for people. And then the absurdities become realities.
Yeah. And I can't remember, was your character always a hardcore right winger, or did that only creep in the show after 2016?
I think it's crept in a little earlier than that. We had, you know, I think we forget, maybe I don't forget, but that this has been going on with, you know, with Sarah Palin from 2008.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and then the Herman Cain presidency, Cain candidacy, not the presidency, but there had been this kind of on the right, this sort of, devoid of seriousness, cartoonishly, you know, absurd characters coming into the political spectrum. You know, I think Sarah Palin's kind of the first really big one that I can remember being kind of like, what the hell is going on? You know, and that's starting to affect my writing, I guess, that you could present these extremely arrogant know-nothings as comedic characters.
And I remember you did a whole album of Herman Cain parody songs, didn't you?
I remember seeing that. If you remember that commercial that came out for a campaign ad, which was his campaign manager, and he was smoking that cigarette in the commercial, and it felt like it had just been made like on an iPhone, like the first iPhone, you know. And it was so hilarious and shocking that was what they were putting out there. I went home and just started writing this song as if from the perspective of kind of an insane person who was a big fan of Herman Cain. And that just became a nice vessel to keep writing.
Did you ever hear what he thought of what you were doing? Did he maybe even took it seriously?
On his deathbed, he passed on his appreciation for the attention I gave him. No, I never heard any word.
Yeah, we just lost him. I guess he didn't have access to Trump's special magical COVID elixir or something.
No. No, I guess not.
Speaking of that, I know that you've also had a music career over the years. When you were young, what was your big passion? Was it the music, the acting, film? Did you view one as your main path over another?
I think music was always front and center growing up because you could do it. You could do it with your friends and you could get a four-track machine and make a demo, and you could make posters and write songs. The comedy thing really felt so far away, and you know, very few comedians are very funny when they're young. You know, there's a lot of, you think you're funny and you and your friends joke around, but I think that takes a little more living to build up sort of something that is worth here showing people. Same for the music. I mean, my music wasn't great either, but so then, you know, I kind of shifted to film and thinking I could work and make, you know, be a part of making movies in some way. But again, comedy was like Jerry Seinfeld. It was big on the, it was just not something we thought about as like a thing we would ever do. Kind of like fell into it through making videos and making what we thought was kind of like little art projects. And that kind of intersected with something that was happening on the internet. And, you know, here we are today.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, when you were growing up, say in high school and stuff, you're about the same age as me. So you probably remember the days when we didn't have Final Cut back then. You know, the kids today, they have access to everything. They could be making, you know, commercials for mainstream television and stuff.
Yeah. We just had a handy cam, like an eight millimeter handy cam, the family home movie recorder that you could do some like in camera edits with, and that was about it. You know, we didn't have any way to put anything together.
Yeah. And where did you meet Eric Wareheim? Was that in college? Your Tim and Eric?
Yeah, we went to Temple University in Philadelphia, and we're in the same film program together. So we were in similar classes. We ended up being roommates for a while. And
yeah, if I have this right, you guys were still plugging away on the East Coast and making these low budget sketch videos when I guess Baba Odenkirk of all people discovered you and gave you a big break, right?
Yeah, we kind of sent our early stuff to people that we admired and saw some of our influence or their influence in our work. Mm-hmm. And Bob was not, of course, the household name he is now, but for us he was kind of a comedy legend. And he was in a place in his life, I think, where he was really interested in, I think he still is, but I think at the time he was really open to helping and finding new comedy talent. And he saw that in us pretty much right away and really was a guiding force in our lives for many years after that.
Yeah, I was just talking to Jack Black and Kyle Gass, who have a pretty similar story. And I think there are a number of stories like that. Odenkirk just is very generous in that way and helping young comics out. And it's weird because I don't know if he feels an obligation to pay it forward and uses his own success to advocate for others, or if, you know, as I suspect, maybe the he's just such a comedy nerd that mm-hmm. when he finds someone funny, there's almost this selfish need to see that person succeed and see them create more of what he likes and enjoys.
I think it's probably a little bit of both. He really cares about it and he has a lot of opinions about it. Mm-hmm. And there's just a lot of stuff out there that, you know, that doesn't pass the smell test for a lot of us picky people. So there's no greater joy that I've had than in my professional life than showing Bob something and him like laughing like an idiot at it, you know, and just, that's such a cool experience. It's happened a few times. A lot of times it's like, great, great. You know, like, this is great. Getting that it's working. But then when you can get him and knock him in the stomach and knock him over or something, it's pretty, pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to remember the sketch that he did. There was one where I think David Cross was, he was directing David Cross, right?
On our show?
Yeah.
That there could be.
I'm trying to remember the whole
setup. You'd have to ask our audience because they know the show way better than we do.
They're hardcore. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. I mean, I adored Tim and Eric Awesome Show because there were so many layers to just every sketch. You know, where you ended was usually so far from where you began with a sketch. No sketch was ever exactly what you thought it was going to be.
Yeah, we had a very, short attention span. We very much wanted this show to be funny on multiple levels and to never tire. You know, we coming from something like, not that we came from this, but the sketch world of Saturday Night Live, where you had to fill 90 minutes, is very different than a sketch world where you have to fill 11 minutes. And we wanted to pack in as much as we could in those 11 minutes and never hang on anything that wasn't was had lost its charm, mm-hmm. you know. So it made it, you know, it made it a fun experiment to try to get out of something as soon as it stopped being funny, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the other thing that I think really distinguished it from other sketch shows is there was this really unusual human element to it, because, you know, even though it was all for laughs, you still revealed all of these fundamental frailties and insecurities that everyone experiences.
Oh, well, thank you. I think we were always interested in the frustrations and, you know, complications of modern life. And mm-hmm. those were some of my favorite sketches too. And I think about the sketch where Eric is just trying to do something at this ATM and he has to keep writing these insane things in. And this voice activated thing is mishearing him. And they keep saying Targus, yeah. Targus. And he's getting more and more frustrated. And I feel like, yeah, we all experience that probably on a daily basis these days.
And when you and Eric were tossing around ideas for sketches, was there sort of a mental idea of what a Tim and Eric sketch should be? What was that process like?
Yeah.
What is it like now?
It's almost like what a Tim and Eric sketch wouldn't be. It's almost like a process of elimination.
Okay.
We wouldn't ever really want to do anything that felt racially motivated, or sort of like identity politics kind of. Yeah. Sketches, or certainly not current events, politics. There are certain things. It's like, I don't know how to explain it, but there are certain things that are funny in the Tim and Eric world and certain things that aren't. And we kind of just intrinsically knew there are a lot of very funny people that we knew wouldn't work on the show, you know, that just didn't fit the vibe. Like, I don't know, even like Jack Black, who I love and was on Tom Goes the Mayor. We always felt like, would him being on Awesome Show take us out of the show in a weird way? Like certain levels of celebrity didn't work, because it felt like too inside Hollywood or something. But
yeah,
I don't know. It was a weird thing. It was a gut feeling of like, it doesn't feel like our show.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the casting, because one of the things that made it so fun and so interesting was that so many of the people seemed very close to the characters that they were playing, or yeah. they didn't seem like central casting, some actor coming in for a particular role. There was a certain authenticity that came across a lot of times.
Yeah. We realized that pretty early, that we loved, you know, the real people and what's funny about real people. And we definitely didn't want to do something where we had like a sketch comedy 30-year-old wearing a white wig and bad age makeup to play an older character. Mm-hmm. So, and we didn't want to have like a sketch troupe. You know, there's certain things about sketch comedy that we just really didn't like personally, you know. And so I think the first episode of that show, we had somebody play my dad, and it was this guy, Richard Dunn, who, God, was just so funny naturally and just looked funny and had a funny attitude, didn't belong on a sketch comedy show, but he had natural instincts of being funny, you know. He was just a funny guy, so that kind of inspired us to continue that approach.
Is it true that somehow the QAnon conspiracy latched onto something from the show? I don't know what sketch or what episode that would have been, but somehow there's a QAnon connection, which surprised me.
Yeah, I mean, it's insane and it's complicated, but there was this child clown outlet that sketched the running Steve Mahanahan's child clown outlet, which was just,
oh, I love that sketch.
Yeah.
It's and, so weird.
Yeah. And it's very weird. And it's like, it's this sketch about, it's sort of like a, you know, local commercial, like they're selling appliances, but they're selling child clowns. And there's all sorts of weird stuff in there about, you know, put these kids in cages and they, you know, punish these kids if they don't dance right. And yeah. At the time, I mean, you can only imagine, like, we're mid-20s and we're just trying to make each other laugh. We're just trying to go into absurd, weird places and make funny stuff to us, but with absolutely no, like, you know, winking or it's any kind of like message that's supposed to be read, and not thinking at all about like Pizzagate, or then this stuff just doesn't exist. It's like 10 years ago, you know, so.
Well, it doesn't exist now.
Well, exactly. I mean, but like even the well, conspiracy. I mean,
there's Jeffrey Epstein and all that. But, yeah, the
QAnon. So in the past couple of years, and Will Ferrell is in one of the sketches. And so, you know, the past couple of years, it got picked up by one of those QAnon nuts being like, well, look at this. This is sick. Yeah. This is the pedophile ring. They have these child clowns. And I'm like, child clown? What the hell are child clowns? It's not a thing. It's not even a... It's just absurd. And yeah. So it's wild, but it's just crazy to see stuff dug up from your past where it's like the context. Yeah. You have to remember, we were just trying to make stupid stuff. We had no Hollywood pedophile ring associations, and there aren't any, right? So yeah. The more you talk about it, the more nuts you start sounding. And that's right. I think that's part of their strategy is to just... Mm-hmm. Drive you nuts.
Yeah. 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 It's amazing. It's a weird world we're living in right now, at least for the next day or so.
Yeah.
Now you're in this great new series, Moonbase 8 for Showtime. Can you set us up? What's the show about?
Well, it's about these three guys who are in a NASA training program to live on the moon, on a moon base. And in the show, the idea is that NASA, you know, we're maybe a few years in the future or something where there are people going up there more regularly, which is kind of happening or about to happen, I think, in the next few years. But it's essentially, you know, like the Three Stooges go to the moon or something. It's like these guys are certainly not qualified to do any of this, but we like to think, you know, this is Moonbase 8 and there's lots of them going on. There's lots of training exercises going on. I think, you know, without giving too much away, I think NASA is probably learning more about the experience than the guys are, you know? But it's really just a slightly transparent excuse to get me, Fred, and John together to try to make some laughs happen for everybody. And we ended up really having fun doing it. And
I'll bet.
And, you know, trying to find a way to do a show about space or about, you know, the space program that's not super cynical, that's not making fun of it. We generally love the idea of exploring the universe and the science that goes behind that. And we kind of wanted to maybe make a show that made you feel good about that idea and root for these guys that even though it's a comedy, that there is this sort of, you know, romantic idea of that we all have about going out there into the world, into the universe.
Yeah, I think it's hilarious. It's honestly the funniest new series I've seen this year. And we've had a number of not so great space comedies come out this year. Space Force was pretty meh. Avenue 8 was really bad, in my opinion, despite these stellar casts and huge showrunners like Greg Daniels and Armando Iannucci from Veep. Yeah, I guess the secret must be to make a show about wanting to go to space rather than actually going there.
That might be it. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to slag those other shows. I think I kind of stayed away from watching because I didn't want to be. We made this kind of before those shows, or maybe while they were making them. It wasn't certainly after. But I guess I'm glad to hear your opinion of it and that you liked our show. But
oh yeah.
It wasn't so much about the sci-fi of it. It was really kind of about the interpersonal relationships and the conflicts of these three guys and anything where the stakes are really high, but it's also kind of fake is funny to us. You know, guys pretending. It could have been easily a show about Civil War reenactors, you know, anything where it's like, John is such a great actor and so committed. And the idea of him like suiting up in a spacesuit to go outside in the desert, in the Arizona desert, is funny, but yeah, maybe you're right. It's about wanting to go, not necessarily having to go.
Yeah, I think it is so damn funny. Like I said, best new comedy that I've seen this year. And all of you are great in it. Is this your first time working with Fred and John?
No, well, I've done John and I've done Steve Brule together. Check It Out with Steve Brule.
Okay.
For a long time, but Fred's done some awesome show, and I did a Portlandia episode. We've just been really good buddies. Like Fred and I and John, we all have this shared love of very similar. You know, we love the Beatles. Fred and I are kind of uber geeks about the Beatles. Like we read every book that comes out, and so we you know, have a really easy, loose friendship. We love doing bits and being silly, and or not silly is the wrong word, but you know. So it was just the show was really like, you know, how can we get together and do something that we'll be proud of, but also that would be fun to do together.
And in some descriptions, I've seen you and the director, Jonathan Kreisel, listed as showrunners for Moonbase 8. But then I've also seen all of you listed as co-stars, yeah, co-writers, and co-creators.
That's the way I don't know where. I saw some promotional thing for an Australian network that was broadcasting.
Oh, really?
From the mind of Jonathan Kreisel. And it was like, okay, that's not exactly accurate, but whatever. No, it was very like equal. Four of us equally coming together to do this together. And we all, of course, had different roles at different points. But, you know, I've worked with Kreisel. He was our editor and director on the first things we ever did. But, you know, he came in and helped shape it as far as making it look great and the story, you know, making it feel like it had some heart and it had characters that were fleshed out more, and you know, a show that isn't just us goofing around, frankly. Mm-hmm. You know, that was kind of the genesis of it, but we didn't want it to be just that.
Yeah, it sounds like it was a very collaborative process, sort of all hands on deck, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah, Jonathan Kreisel, I have to say, he's such a lovely guy. I had him on a couple of years back for Baskets.
Oh, yeah.
And I somehow pronounced his name correctly and incorrectly in the same interview.
He was still don't know
so
how
gracious
I,
not to call me.
Kreisel, there's lots of different ways you can.
Right. And each of these three astronauts has their own motives for wanting to go to the moon. I don't want to give away too much here, but you know, John's trying to redeem his reputation and recover from a failed marriage and a mountain of debt. In Fred's case, he's following the footsteps of his astronaut father and has some issues around that. Tell us, why does your character want to go to the moon?
Well, he's been sent on a mission by his pastor. So he's sort of a evangelical Christian, and in a very kind of broad comedy sense, we find that he's got a dozen children, young children, sort of that, what's that show? Whatever that was. Sort of that world. And I think there's this sense that maybe the pastor has suggested this because he's got ulterior motives at the home there. But yeah, this idea that made us laugh, that there was this guy that whose mission was literally a mission in the sense of a missionary project to go out there and be the, I always liked, you know, in shows like MASH, they had that chaplain. There's always like kind of a sort of benign religious presence in these kind of shows that we thought was funny.
And it's funny, the idea of being a missionary to an uninhabited rock orbiting the earth.
Shows you where the American priorities might lie.
And NASA has taken some hits in recent years, and in one episode you actually reference this relatively new turn of events, which is the fact that NASA suddenly now has all this competition from the private sector, SpaceX, Branson, Bezos, and so on.
Yeah,
it sounds like you're still a NASA true believer, though, from what you said earlier.
I think so. I mean, we did some research and did some field trips. We went to JPL in Pasadena here, and it's where they, you know, the rocket program began. And they're really this, you know, it's really neat to see that there's this pure scientific academic kind of pursuit. And I actually asked them, like, what is the goal? You know, what is the mission here? What is the purpose of JPL? And they're literally sort of just looked at me and said, you know, to better understand the universe, to discover, to know more about who we are and what's out there. And that's basically it, you know, and all the stuff around it about this mechanics of the rockets and the physics of it and all that stuff are kind of all in serving that purpose. So That is really inspiring to me, that there's people that go to work every day to do that. On the other side of town is SpaceX, where they're, you know, literally building rockets, and there's people running around, and it feels like you're at like Google with the amount of, you know, hoodies being worn and people with mohawks and stuff, and there's a real different energy, which it's, you know, ultimately, you know, they each serve each other in different ways. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And I enjoy how you kind of touch on that in one of the episodes for the show.
Yeah.
You bring in one of these companies into the picture. But it does sound like, from what you said about JPL, that NASA is still populated by starry-eyed dreamers. And whereas, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know, SpaceX, Branson, and Elon Musk, there seems to be a lot of ego to it with them, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's part of it that maybe those guys really do feel like this. I know Jeff Bezos has this, and it's partly ego and extreme like narcissistic tendencies to think that they're the ones to do it. But right. It is this idea of like, who else is gonna step up? Because somebody's gotta, we have to start making some big moves, you know, like this planet's not going to be habitable forever, no matter what happens. So if the life itself continues, it's going to require us to get comfortable with spreading out a little bit.
And you kind of get into the whole moon versus Mars idea in this show. Some people think that going to the moon's a waste of time, and you know, we should maybe focus on Mars. Others think that we need to go back to the moon and use it as a first stepping stone to Mars, and sort of a launching point of sorts. Which camp do you fall into? Or can you do both?
I think you have to kind of do both. But we did kind of go back and forth on this as we were writing it. We kind of stuck with Moonbase. Moonbase, the title came like, God, that's just a good title, you know, like we don't want to lose that. There's something kind of romantic about the moon, and we've been there before, but it's funny, we almost did switch it to that. We were going to be training to go to Mars. And because that at the time we were writing it, that was a little more in the news, a little more sort of realistic. But since then, it's really kind of going back to the moon again. And it is there is a real practical reason to go to the moon. It's right there. And, you know, you can use that, like they say, as a much more efficient and affordable launching pad to go to Mars. So I feel like the moon is in vogue, and we found water there the other day.
Oh yeah.
So all good promotional, preambling for our premiere, which we're appreciative.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Coordinating that so well.
Yeah, I think there's also something sweet about these three guys. While all the private sector is focused on going to Mars and doing these big quote unquote moonshots, but much bigger goals, and these guys are still romantically fixated on going to the moon. There's something charming about that, isn't there?
It harkens back to the 60s and sort of the original space race. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I love this idea that there are other moon bases that are competing. You know, it's almost like I'm waiting to see if this is going to turn out to be a reality show.
Right. Yeah. I think by making the show, you know, we learned a lot about what works and what doesn't. And it's a fun thing to think about making more, because we learned so much about the characters by, you know, making it, that you want to find out, where is this all going? And are there other, it opens up a whole world of are there other moon bases, and how did these guys get in the program? Like, you know, you could, if you want, you could go backwards. You could go and see them up on the moon. Like, you know, anything's possible in the future.
Yeah. I hope that you get a second season, a third season, fourth season, and who knows? Because I really found it so damn funny, and I really hope people watch it. Again, Moonbase 8 premieres on Showtime Sunday, November 8th at 11 p.m. Eastern and Pacific. Tim Heidecker, thanks for talking with me.
Congrats. Thank you so much, man. Great to talk to you, Ben.
Thanks again to Tim Heidecker for coming on the show. Once again, Moonbase 8 debuts Sunday, November 8th at 11 p.m. Eastern and Pacific, only on Showtime. And keep up with Tim at timheidecker.com or on Twitter at Tim Heidecker. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.